It is time that we put an end to some of the hysteria about the so-called new apostolic reformation.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to today's broadcast. Friends, you're going to find today's show very helpful, clarifying, edifying. I'll get into our subject matter momentarily, but here's the number to call. If you have any kind of Bible-related, theology-related question, give me a call, 866-348-7884. That's 866-34-TRUTH. By all means, give me a call. If I get into the subject and you have a specific question about the things we're talking about on the air, by all means, give me a call. Just a moment of background. I did a two-hour interview last week on a podcast that was hosted by a woman named Elisa Childers. And on the show were Holly Pivek and Doug Guyvett, who've written about what they would term the New Apostolic Reformation. And I was on it as well. We took 2 hours. I think it was constructive. For me, it was eye-opening, not just doing it, but seeing the comments afterwards. And I'm going to do my best to give clarity once and for all on this broadcast as to my issues with the term New Apostolic Reformation. All right. But first, I want to talk to you about dealing with destructive criticism. Dealing with destructive criticism. Over the weekend, I tweeted this out. It's far more productive to spend 1 hour teaching serious disciples than 1,000 hours responding to critics who've already rejected you and your position. Can I repeat that? It's far more productive to spend 1 hour teaching serious disciples than 1,000 hours responding to critics who have already rejected you and your position. Let's say you're a pastor and you have a thriving congregation, but you have some disgruntled former members that don't like your method of teaching the word or think you're majoring on the wrong subject. So they quit coming to your church and they start a blog criticizing you. All right, your congregants come. They love the Lord. They really appreciate your ministry. They love your teaching. Do you think they're coming to hear you talked about the critics and why the critics are wrong and why the critics are missing the point? No, they're there to be fed and nurtured and taught because they appreciate your message. Let's say you own a restaurant and you've got regular customers that have coming for years, and you do your best to provide them with a healthy menu and an enjoyable menu and well-priced, and that's why you've got faithful customers, clients that have been coming for years, all right? Now you have some food critic that doesn't like your food, doesn't like your method of cooking, doesn't like the ambiance, doesn't like where you're located, and he blasts you on a website, all right? Do you think the people that come there regularly want to hear you get up and walk around from table to table and tell you why the critics are wrong, all right? Tell them why the critics are wrong? Or do you think that those people that are there so that they can get the food that they like? So here's my point. By nature, I'm a debater. All right, for better or worse. I love to interact with those who differ. If I have my druthers, I prefer getting calls from people that differ with me than people who agree with me. If I have my druthers when I go to give a talk on a campus, I'd rather do a debate than just do a talk. I love to have my views challenged. I love to interact. That's not the issue. And I'll reach out patiently to those who differ as much as I have the opportunity to. But there are folks who are critical. They have rejected your position or my position. They're not in our camp. I will never satisfy them. You will never satisfy them. I'm not saying they're bad people or evil people. I'm simply saying, in most cases, it is a waste of time. I tweeted this out as well. One thing I've learned recently when it comes to refuting myths and exaggerations and misconceptions, it's a lot easier to start a fire than to put one out. Conspiracy theories are hard to debunk. if someone is going to claim that I'm a 33-degree Mason or whatever it's called, and I said, I don't know anything about being a Mason, you go, aha, that proves it. You're denying it. It's very difficult to refute that kind of nonsense. And what I'm seeing as I do my best to define things, to address things scripturally, to address things based on experience and what I know, if it doesn't fit the conspiratorial theory, it's going to be rejected out of hand. That's going to be further proof that I'm part of the conspiracy. How do you deal with that? How do you refute that? And is it even worth your time to try to dispel someone of a false notion that's not based on truth? Let me go a little further. I tweeted this out. Just as a restaurant tailors its menu to its customers rather than to its hostile critics, so also pastors should focus on nurturing their flocks rather than trying to please their hostile critics. Catering to critics is a trap. Here, I have folks call the show and say, Dr. Brown, I love your broadcast. I listen regularly. I agree with so much of what you say, but I have concerns about this, or I have concerns about that. Or I don't know why you work with so-and-so. Okay, great. That's an honest question, and I'll give the most honest answer I can. Someone else calls, Dr. Brown, I'm really wondering about this. Could you sort this out for me? I do my best to answer honestly, only to find out it's some critic who's now going to pull that and put this up on a YouTube site or somewhere else to try to expose me. That I find completely unethical. Call and say, this is so-and-so. I differ with you. My positions are against yours. I'm not charismatic. I don't believe in this and that. And I'd like to ask you honestly about this. Great, we can have a conversation. But the other stuff seems to be so non-constructive and with a predetermined outcome. In other words, if I fend off that accusation with a truthful answer that satisfies them, it doesn't change their position, just means they go to the next question. In other words, the verdict is already made up. That I find to be constructive criticism rather than constructive criticism. I was talking to a friend the other day, and I mentioned to him how many positive reports I get, people thanking me for being gracious in my debates and things like that. And he said, well, don't just listen to the ones who speak positive things. Listen to the critics, too. I said, oh, trust me. For every positive word I get from my wife, I get 100 constructive critical words. Trust me, I'm hearing that day and night. And I welcome it. I welcome it from my team. I welcome it from strangers. If it's constructive, if it's life-giving, if it's not just to satisfy a predetermined outcome, wonderful. But here, let me lay some things out for you, all right? Why is it that virtually all of the critics who call the show, who write articles, who have websites attacking me, put out YouTube videos, etc., why is it that virtually all of them are non-charismatic or anti-charismatic? Where are the charismatic critics blasting me for my friendship with Southern Baptists? Where are the charismatic critics putting out YouTube videos about my association with strong Calvinists? Where are the charismatic critics blasting me for teaching at non-charismatic seminaries? Notice the criticism is from one particular camp or groups in a particular camp, and they are all coming from one direction, which fundamentally has an issue with the things of the Spirit today and with some of the abuses in the midst of the genuine moving of the Spirit. Here's a question for you. Since when am I accountable for whatever my friends and colleagues practice and say? Here, I am 10 times better friends, 100 times better friends with James White than Bill Johnson, all right? I've sat, in terms of my total conversations face-to-face with Bill Johnson, I would say just the two of us talking face-to-face, total, in our lifetimes, 10 minutes? Maybe. The longest conversation he ever had was when he was on my radio show, when he spent an hour with me on the radio. That's the longest conversation we had. But face-to-face, just the two of us, a few minutes here and there. You say, why do you say you're friends? Because I've known him in different circles for years. I'm friends with friends that have worked closely with him. We have a common heart for revival and the things of the Spirit. But if I was there all the time, I might differ with half of the sermons preached. I might differ with half of the books written by his team. I might differ with lots of stuff, okay? The same way, Dr. White, we spent hours together fellowshipping face to face. We've worked out together. We've had meals together. We've debated each other. We've debated side by side against others. We've interacted regularly off the air. We've been on one another's shows. And yet there are many things he differs with me on, I differ with him. Why? How come I'm not accountable for everything he believes? Since when do you judge someone based on how they respond to their circle of friends and associates and colleagues here? I teach at numerous seminaries. Some of them have beliefs that you don't agree with. Am I accountable for what the seminary says? I work with different publishers. On the radio station where you're listening or the TV station where you're watching, there are all kinds of shows. Am I now responsible for all of those? I recently did a conference for a friend of mine who's one of the most prominent Southern Baptist pastors in the country. Am I now responsible that he teaches once saved, always saved as a Southern Baptist? I presume he does. Are you going to blast me for that? See, it's not a matter of wanting to hold me accountable for my friends and associates, which is completely bogus. Look, I've written, 32 books or something like that? I've written well over 1,000 articles. We have well over 1,000 videos out. I've preached thousands of messages. How many radio shows have we done? God knows. Hold me accountable for that. Judge me based on that with joy. But please, if you hear that so-and-so, I preached at so-and-so's church, I preached there a few times, and they had another guest speaker, and the guest speaker said that's not my business, okay? Call that church. If I endorsed a book, and the book has some problems, challenge me on that, because now I'm endorsing it. But I have a large circle of friends, charismatic, non-charismatic, Calvinist, non-Calvinist, some denominational, some outside of denominations. I have friends that are absolute megachurch friends. They're megachurch all the way. I have others that are house church all the way that wouldn't go near a megachurch, and they're all friends. I have friends who've written books that are on the exact opposite side of major issues, not issues that we divide over in the faith, but major issues that cause great discussion in the faith, and I'm friends with both, and I work with both because of the common good of the gospel. So come on, friends, let's go deeper. Let's grow up. Let's focus on serving a dying world and building up the body and helping one another and glorifying Jesus. And let's judge fairly and righteously and not get caught up in this silly, meaningless, non-productive, destructive dribble. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right. We sometimes say on this show that we serve as your voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity in the midst of a society in chaos and a church all too often in compromise. I want to do my best to bring you some spiritual clarity. Here's the number to call if you've got any question for me relating to what we're talking about or Bible question in general, 866-348-7884. Let me do my best to bring you some clarity about the so-called New Apostolic Reformation, otherwise known as NAR. I'm going to give you an analogy as I see it. I've been really trying to think of simple ways to convey this that everyone can take hold of and then evaluate. Let's go over to the mall. Let's go over to the food court in the mall. There is one of the little food court options. You know, you've got your Burger King and McDonald's, or you've got your Sbarro's, or you've got your whatever the Chinese one is, or some healthy option, or whatever, or Subway, whatever the different options are for food. So there's one we're going to call NPR, the New Pizza Reformation, all right? NPR, the New Pizza Reformation. And this one says that the going thing now is this new pizza they're making. And really, this is the food. This is the way to go, all right? It is the way to go. It is the most important one there, the NPR, the New Pizza Reformation, all right? That's what it's called. Well, now you have the rest of the food options in the mall, okay? And those food options think that pizza's great. They enjoy pizza, but they believe that pizza's good for today, but it's just one of a number of different food options. We're going to liken that now to those who agree with certain points of what would be the new apostolic reformation, which we'll define more clearly, but do not agree with the other points. Then you have the rest of the mall, the whole mall. That I'm going to liken to the whole charismatic Pentecostal church. You say, okay, you lost me already, so let me back it up. New Apostolic Reformation was a name that was used by Peter Wagner, who's with the Lord now. Peter Wagner. He was a professor for many years at Fuller Theological Seminary. He had been a missionary before that. And he felt that he was raised up by God as an apostle, that God was raising up apostles all over the world, and that God wanted apostles to be in their proper place in the church, and that that was essential for the good of the church. There were many things he taught that I agreed with, that I thought were positive and biblical. There were other things that I differed with. He had a particular network of leaders that he oversaw. I was never part of that network of leaders, one reason being I differed with some of the philosophy. Now, that's the NPR. That's the new pizza revolution. Pizza is it. The way we make it, pizza, that's it. Well, I have believed for decades in what we call fivefold ministry. I have believed for decades in apostles and prophets today based on reading the New Testament, based on seeing the fact that the gift of prophecy was to continue until Jesus returned, based on the fact that others outside the 12 were called apostles, and based on Ephesians 4, which said that Jesus gave apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers until a certain point. And we haven't reached that point yet. So as I looked at Scripture, I thought, well, then they're still here today. When I saw the way Peter Wagner defined it, I agreed with some parts and differed strongly with other parts. All right? So the food court of the mall, that's everybody who believes fivefold ministry is today, is for today, but they don't agree with everything taught by the NPR, all right? So in my analogy, they believe, yeah, pizza's good and healthy, but pizza's one of many different options. The NPR says, no, pizza is the way. Then you have the rest of the mall. That's not even, I mean, that's just massive. That's a lot of other stuff. And that's the whole charismatic Pentecostal church, much of which doesn't even know about the discussion about apostles and prophets today or how it works out, or doesn't use that terminology. For example, some of the largest Pentecostal denominations in the world don't use the terminology of apostles or prophets today. All right, so it's very simple to me. There is something very specific called the New Apostolic Reformation, which would have a certain number of people that would strongly identify with its principles. Then you make a bigger circle around that, a much bigger circle. That's all the charismatics Pentecostals who believe in fivefold ministry today, but most of them never heard of NAR. Many of them don't know who Peter Wagner is, and many would disagree with many of the points that would be taught by Peter Wagner. Then you get the biggest circle. That's the charismatic Pentecostal movement as a whole. From what I can see, the critics of NAR are taking all the abuses and problems in the larger charismatic Pentecostal movement and grouping them together under NAR, and then saying that it is somehow networked or has certain common beliefs or whatever, and this is untrue, it is exaggerated, and it presents very false pictures. Now, ask yourself a question. Why did I write a whole book called Playing with Holy Fire, A Wake-Up Call to the Pentecostal Charismatic Church? Just came out early this month. Why did I write a whole book, Whatever Happened to the Power of God as the Charismatic Church Slain in the Spirit or Down for the Count, in 1991? Why did I write these whole books, as well as other books over the years that have interacted with abuses or things I've differed with in the charismatic Pentecostal movement, including calling out the overuse of terms like apostle, making everybody into an apostle, or abuse of authority, or things like that? Why would I address all these things freely and yet deny my alleged association with NAR? It doesn't make any sense. If these are the abuses and I'm addressing them head on, then why would I deny the other part? I deny the other part because the other part is simply non-existent. Here, let me give you an example. Let's look at this website, Six Hallmarks of a NAR Church, the Berean Examiner, the Six Hallmarks of a NAR Church, posted June 7th, 2016. So you scroll down, and number one is this, apostles. We're in, quote, a second apostolic age. There are new apostles on the earth today, anointed by the laying on of hands to represent and speak for God here on earth. These, quote, super apostles are equal to the original apostles. The ones who witnessed Jesus' life, death, and resurrection were appointed by Christ himself to the office. Since these new apostles are commissioned by God, their authority may not be questioned. Frankly, I don't know anybody who believes that. There's no one that I've worked with, including people that were part of Peter Wagner's organization that would be called New Apostolic Reformation properly, okay? I don't know any of them that believe that. If Peter Wagner believed that, I'm not aware of it. If he did believe that, I categorically reject it, all right? But I don't know anyone, people that use the title apostle today, I don't know any of them that believe that. So this would exclude every church I've ever worked with anywhere in the world ever in my life, because I don't know any that hold to that. And some of the so-called major NAR leaders today, all right, I don't know any of them that hold to that definition either, that would go in that direction at all. Here, let's go down to number six. NAR denies the sufficiency of Scripture. NAR adherents may believe in the inerrancy and authority of the Bible, but God's breathed out word is just not enough for them. Jesus' sacrificial death for our sins is not good enough. The promise of eternal life in heaven is not good enough. I don't know anybody that believes that. I've never worked with a leader in the world that believes that. You say, well, but aren't they constantly seeking new revelation? Well, first, my question is, who's the they? Who is they? You say, well, anyone who believes they're apostles today. Well, wait, hang on. Hang on. My friend, Bishop Joe Matera, Dr. Joe Matera, now leads the U.S. Council of Apostolic Leaders, which is originally Peter Wagner's organization of, quote, apostles. Joe Matera said, I'll take it over, but first, I'll lead it. First condition is you have to change from apostles to apostolic leaders. First change he made. Why? There are reasons for it. And he just wrote an article. This is the man who is leading. So just like leading a network, leading a fellowship of leaders, helping to facilitate, coordinate, bringing them together, okay? He is leading the organization Peter Wagner used to lead, and he has a major critique of many things commonly associated with New Apostolic Reformation. He doesn't agree with these things. For example, and if you're watching, I can't pull these quotes up for you right now, but he said this. He said, the present apostolic paradigm will bring a course correction to the New Apostolic Reformation and view the apostolic as a ministry function, not as an office, as an adjective, not a title. He said this, the present apostolic paradigm will correct the autocratic, top-down, hierarchical government of many in the NAR. So he's talking about the NPR, I'm calling it, the New Pizza Revolution. In other words, as rightly defined, the NAR, and mimic the servant leadership style of Jesus, who came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Dr. Matera writes this, the present apostolic paradigm will not spout triumphalist dominion rhetoric, like the church is called to take cities, when rather the church is called to love and serve our cities. Those who serve the best are the greatest problem solvers who eventually lead anyway. And then he points out in Genesis 1, when God told Adam, take dominion over the earth, it was over the cattle and the animals and the world. It wasn't over other people. Our goal, our call is not to take dominion over other people. So here is a recognized leader leading the organization that Peter Wagner once led, that you could rightly call New Apostolic Reformation. So this is our narrow picture here, all right? And he is bringing major correction to errors in it. And yet he would be called part of, quote, NAR, even though he is rejecting much of what NAR stood for. This is a big problem. The ambiguity of definitions, the guilt by association, the casting a wide net by which everybody's guilty of this nefarious conspiratorial plot when it's simply doesn't exist.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us today on The Line of Fire. I want to open the phone lines. You've got questions. We've got answers. As always, on Friday, we're unable to get to many folks that try to call or do call, and so many write in. We do our best to respond as much as we can with our team, but we try to open the phones extra here and there. So anything you want to ask me about, questions that have come up, things you have wondered about, 866-348-7884. I want to help bring clarity to some controversies within the body today. But first, let's go to the phones in Woodstock, Georgia. Eric, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown, for having me.
You're welcome.
Yes, sir. Just real quick, how do you, as an experienced just minister, man of God, you know, there on the front lines, out in the public, how do you deal with not so much laymen, but ministers who've been teaching the scriptures for years, but have just flat out and militantly rejected the gifts of the Spirit and are very open and somewhat rude about it? Like, how do you, scripturally and through experience, how do you deal with that?
Well, the first thing is, if it's just a battle to fight, in other words, here's somebody who differs with me and is just attacking all the time online, if I see that they're not genuinely looking for dialogue and they're not willing to really study the issue together, their minds are made up and the ship has sailed in that respect, well, hey, God bless you. Hope you have a great life in ministry, but I'm not here to fight with you. If we can join together for other purposes, in other words, we're standing together on pro-life issues, or we're standing together against LGBT activism, or we're standing together for Israel, hey, I'll work with lots of people. That's why I have such a wide association of friends, and they differ with me on lots of things. I differ with them on lots of things. They're not accountable for what I say. I'm not accountable for what they say, but there are big issues we work together on. And to be honest, there are some cases, folks I work with, say, on moral cultural issues, I have no idea if they're charismatic or not, or where they stand on lots of other things. And there are folks who are Catholic, and we're standing together for pro-life issues. And obviously, we have profound differences when it comes to what we believe about Catholicism. So when it comes to this, if somebody is attacking, aggressive, if I feel to reach out to them, I try to do that. If they're a very prominent leader like John MacArthur in Strange Fire Conference, then to me, I'd want to reach out if I can. If it's someone else that's prominent and that's respected, that would be a good opponent, I'd say, hey, why don't we have a civil debate about this for the goal of educating the body? But if they're basically, they're set and they're critical, well, hey, you do what you feel to do, and I just go on. Pray for them, pray for God's best. And I pray prayers that are not judgmental in the sight of God, meaning I'll pray for that person. I'll pray for myself together. I'll say, Father, bring us into the fullness of your Spirit and the fullness of your truth. Everything you have for us, bring us into that. So I'm not, Lord, help him because I'm so holy. Help him. I'll pray prayers even in the sight of God in that way. But otherwise, certain times you just have to leave it. There are plenty of people that I have blocked on Twitter and Facebook that are just downright nasty, or it's clear all they're going to do is post disagreement. Whatever I post, they're going to differ. Some I'll mute, and others, if they get nasty, I'll block. I don't like doing it, but it's just a waste of time otherwise, absolute waste of time.
Right. So pretty much taking the same approach like what the Lord did when the Pharisees falsely accused him. In fact, the same accusations, or you even find it in the Talmud today, where unfortunately they falsely accuse Yeshua of, practicing sorcery or using the false power of Beelzebub and things of that nature. Because, those same kind of accusations get fired out, and it's, I guess.
Look, the key thing is not to be reactionary. In other words, you want to be constructive. You want to do things that are not just reacting in the flesh. You want to patiently be there with truth. And if it's clear there's just going to be a fight, there's no reason. You end up wasting time. And look, there are folks that have called this show with honest questions, and I do my best to answer honestly. There are folks who call who I know are critics and who differ with me, and we'll have a dialogue. And if it seems to be fruitless, well, I'll stop it at a certain point, but otherwise we'll have a dialogue. There are others who call to try to set me up for something or to try to catch me in a word or quote something that's going to make me look bad if I don't respond the right way. That what's the use of that? I'm not helping them. I'm not helping the listening audience, and we're not advancing the cause of truth. It's just like a silly game. So you have to deal with each one accordingly. It's interesting. In the book of Proverbs, you have two verses back to back. The first one saying, answer a fool according to his folly. Otherwise, he's going to go on to his folly. Then the next, don't answer a fool according to his folly. Otherwise, you'll end up caught up with him. I'm paraphrasing. Now, I'm not calling these people fools. I'm just using this analogously. That basically what happens is that I believe that those verses are both speaking truth. It's not one is negated by the other. And each one depends on the situation and setting. There's a time when it's right to engage. There's a time it's wrong. There's a time it's right to rebuke. There's a time you just stay back. All right. Thank you, sir, for the call. 866-34-TRUTH. Before I go to the phones, let me illustrate something for you. All right. I've been trying to bring clarity to the issue of NAR, so-called New Apostolic Reformation. And as best as I understand things, this was a particular spiritual movement or philosophy of leadership that was led by Dr. Peter Wagner, the late Dr. Wagner, that held to specific understanding of apostolic and prophetic ministry today, some of which I agreed with, some of which I disagreed with. I was never part of his network of leaders for that reason. All right, so that's the smallest circle. And how many hundreds, thousands of leaders does that affect? It's relatively small. Then you have a bigger circle, which is those who believe that apostolic and prophetic ministry exists today, but don't know about NAR, aren't part of NAR, wouldn't agree with many of the parameters that Peter Wagner set. All right? But the critics put them all together. You're all part of NAR. Then the big circle, the modern charismatic Pentecostal movement. And then what happens now is that if you see an abuse somewhere in the modern charismatic Pentecostal movement, it now becomes part of NAR. And NAR is this worldwide massive thing having all this influence. That's what I call a myth. Is there something called the New Apostolic Reformation? Yes, of course. Of course. No one denies that. And it was led by Dr. Peter Wagner and had certain beliefs and parameters. All right? We can define that. We can discuss that. Here's where I agree. Here's where I disagree. There is something larger, which is those who believe in apostolic and prophetic ministry today. And then larger than that, the modern charismatic Pentecostal church, which is, what, 600 million plus worldwide. But the actual NAR, New Apostolic Reformation, is a relatively small movement with relatively small influence. Do I believe God's raising up apostles, prophets, today around the world? Yes, of course. Do I agree with much of what Peter Wagner said? No, once again, to repeat that. So here, let me give you an example. Holly Pivick, with whom I had a dialogue, and her and co-author Doug Guyvett last week on Elisa Childers' podcast, she has on her website, Spirit of Error, 5 tips for identifying NAR churches. So she says, search the internet and then look for words like apostolic or prophetic or fivefold ministry. Well, hang on. On another website, and we'll just scroll down to where it says 5 tips for identifying NAR churches for everyone that's watching. And just leave that on the screen for a minute, all right? So on another website, Holly refers to a very positive review of the book she wrote with Doug Guyvett, by a leader in the Assemblies of God, calling NAR hyper-charismatic and saying Pentecostals and charismatics need to watch it carefully. And yet the Assemblies of God believes in apostolic or prophetic ministry. They just strongly differ with certain principles taught by NAR. And the Assemblies of God, that's the largest Pentecostal denomination worldwide. Okay, she said, read their statement of faith. But the problem is, she said, they may have an Orthodox statement of faith, so that won't really give it away. Well, then pay attention to guest speakers and how they're introduced. Are they referred to as apostles or prophets? There's anyone that happens to believe that they're prophets today, now they're part of NAR. What kind of reasoning is that? Based on whose definition, I ask once again. And then check this out. Look for distinctive NAR practices, such as a church hosting sozo sessions, which is kind of like a holistic ministry for people struggling, be it addictions or problems or other things like that. Or operating a 24/7 prayer room. Wait a second. 24/7 prayer? Is NAR? 24/7 prayer is a distinctive NAR practice? Where is this coming from? I've been involved in churches with 24/7 prayer since I got saved. All right. I mean, some would have a 24-hour prayer meeting once a month. Ministries I work with overseas, they've had at least one person praying 24/7 for decades. crying out to God for souls and for his work? Since when is the Moravians, were the Moravians part of NAR? Because they had a 100-year prayer meeting. Once 100 years straight, continuous prayer. This is what I find frustrating. So here, we go to another website, okay? And I'm trying to sort this out because so much time is wasted over this. Here, go to the website, Elisa Childers' website. She was gracious enough to host a very constructive discussion, two-hour podcast. And then afterwards, I went and looked at comments. Normally, I don't do that just because of busyness and we're on so many different websites and posted in so many places. But here, I wanted to see the comments. So I found these interesting. For example, here's one of the comments on the website. Pastor Chris Roseborough has rightly labeled Michael Brown as the apostle of obfuscation. Brown could not openly admit that the so-called NAR has serious issues because he is part and parcel of it, going at least as far back as the Brownsville Revival. Wait, hang on. The Brownsville Revival? This took place in the Brownsville Assembly of God, pastored by John Kilpatrick, ordained with the Assemblies of God, with the main speaker each night being Steve Hill, Evangelist Steve Hill, now with the Lord, also ordained by the Assemblies of God. Bill Johnson, we're told, is a NAR leader, and one reason we know he's a NAR leader is because he left the Assemblies of God. The Assemblies of God put out a review praising a book attacking NAR by Holly Pivick and Doug Guyvick, which Holly cites on her website. Brownsville Revival was part of the Assemblies of God. We would meet, even though I was in the Assemblies of God, we would meet every year with Thomas Trask, who was then the head of the Assemblies of God. The Assemblies of God are not NAR. The Assemblies of God reject certain fundamental principles that NAR holds to. Yet I'm part of NAR going back to the Brownsville Revival, and I deny it. Therefore, I'm the apostle of obfuscation. Can you see how ridiculous this is? Can you see how fruitless this is? And it is untrue. It is based on false information. Don't people care about truth? And where I see abuses, I've addressed them for years. I've addressed abuses more than about anybody you'll find in the charismatic Pentecostal movement. Whole books on it. Get my new book, Playing with Holy Fire, if you don't believe me. And yet, because I tell the truth about not being part of NAR or rejecting certain things within NAR or saying the NAR critics are exaggerating and even producing hysteria, now I'm, quote, the apostle of obfuscation for telling the truth. Isn't that utterly remarkable? Hey, tell you what, we're going to stay with the truth because 100 years from now, the criticisms and the misunderstanding is going to be long gone. But the good fruit of the gospel that I'm part of and that many others are part of, that's going to remain. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on the Line of Fire. So I want to throw out a few things for you. By all means, hold me accountable for what I teach and preach and believe, but don't hold me accountable for everything my friends teach and preach and believe, because I have friends in all parts of the body. I write regularly for the stream, stream.org. To me, the best place to go on a daily basis to get insight, what's happening in the world around us with a spiritual perspective, and post my articles there and many other websites. I write there regularly, okay? Well, there are folks on the stream that are Catholic, like Jay Richards and John Zmirak, and they are colleagues and friends. I'm not Catholic. I differ with their Catholicism. They differ with my non-Catholicism, and we work together on the stream. You know, one of my dear friends is Dr. James White, a strong Calvinist and a non-charismatic. Are you going to hold me accountable for everything he says? I'm friends with Dr. Jack Graham, leading Southern Baptist pastor, and Pastor Prestonwood Baptist. I spoke at a men's conference for him there with Dr. Ronnie Floyd and other Southern Baptist leaders. Well, they would differ with me on certain things, and I would differ with them on certain things. So why is it that I'm only held accountable for what a Pentecostal friend or a charismatic friend has to say? It's because the critics are charismatic Pentecostal critics. They are critics of the things of the Spirit or the things supposedly of the Spirit today. And most of them are very strong cessationists. So that's where the criticism's coming from. So you've got an issue with something that Jack Graham teaches or James White teaches or Jay Richards wrote or John Zmirak wrote or Bill Johnson said or Cheon said, reach out to them. Interact with them. I work with a lot of people across the board for common good purposes. So let me give you one last example. Then I want to go back to the phones, 866-34-TRUTH. There was a response to the two-hour podcast on NAR that we did last week with Elisa Childers, Doug Guyvett, and Holly Pivick. And appreciate everybody's time in doing that. And someone said this, critical, that was listening. Dr. Brown admits to the abuses and problems being out there in small measure, but will not admit to the abundantly well-documented abuses committed by colleagues he says are great men of God, Bill Johnson, Cheon, Mike Bickle, Brian Simmons. Now, by the way, out of everyone there, I know Mike and Che the best, okay? But I don't know everything they teach or believe or anything about their lives, okay? Nor do they know everything I teach and believe. So, again, hold them accountable for what they say. Hold me accountable for what I say. And I don't, in any case, it's so confusing. I can only assume it's because he either hasn't dug in enough to witness what's truly going on. He readily admits he hasn't been to these places in years. Or he, in fact, thinks fire tunnels, destiny, tarot cards, spirit tuning forks, awakening sleeping angels in the desert, acting literally drunk in the spirit, and spirit mapping, just to name a few coming from or endorsed by Bethel or all biblical practice. Okay, this is some of the nonsense that I personally find non-constructive. Totally non-constructive. What do I mean? Bethel does not endorse using Christian tarot cards. Okay? First thing. And how many churches in the world, charismatic Pentecostal churches, have ever heard of such a thing? One in a million? Seriously. Apparently, a ministry associated with Bethel, or some ministry that referred to Bethel somewhere, when doing New Age outreach, would sit down with people and use these cards. Some of them had scripture, some of them had images on them, and say, hey, let me pray and see if the Lord gives me something to try to reach these people and then preach the gospel to them. It may be a completely bogus practice. I don't know about it. All I know is the little bit that I read. Okay, but I'm not accountable for that. It's complete idiocy to say, well, if they did something somewhere and I call someone a friend, then I'm accountable for everything they did. That is complete and utter nonsense. You should have been flooding me with calls after the Las Vegas massacre when my friend Dr. White, in true Calvinistic spirit, and using verses like Lamentations 3 that says, if calamities come to a city, surely the Lord has ordained it, said that the ultimate reason the Las Vegas massacre happened was because God ordained it. You should have been flooding me with calls, differing, and how can that be? And you differ with that. Well, I understand why he said it. I understand his scriptural basis for saying it, all right? And that's his position based on scripture. Many other Calvinists would agree with him. I understand where he's coming from in it, but I'm not accountable for that. Those are his words. So if there's some practice, it could be the most idiotic practice. It could be a stupid practice. It could be a practice, if I saw it, I'd throw the cards away and say, what in the world are you doing? This is crazy. What are you doing? This is nonsense. I don't know. I just read a little bit about it online. But this is not some, Bethel endorses Christian tarot cards. Why don't you renounce it? Number one, I'm not responsible for renouncing everything Bethel does. If I was there, I might agree with a lot. I might differ with a lot. That's why it wouldn't be my home church. Or someone from Bethel Fire wouldn't be their home church. It's my home congregation. Why? Because you have differences. If I lived near James White, his church wouldn't be my home church because it's not charismatic and it's Calvinist. And if he lived near me, Fire wouldn't be his home church because it is charismatic and it's not Calvinist. And he's not responsible for what we teach at Fire. I'm not responsible for what he teaches in his church. Please, friends, we got to grow up. This type of silly criticism is nothing but silly. So where there are serious abuses, I address them. I've been with Mike Bickle. I've been with his team. And most of the stuff he's accused of isn't true. Simply isn't true. That's simple. What about Brian Simmons in the Passion Translation? Examine it as a translation. It's a paraphrase, really. Examine it like you'd examine any other paraphrase. And that's how I'll examine it. Boy, I like that. Boy, I don't like that. Simple. But friends, we got to move on. This stuff is just people who don't know, people who don't understand, people who are on the outside, people who are misinformed, people who had one bad experience and then project it on the whole. It's draining people. It's creating hysteria. And what I'd encourage you to do is, okay, here, one pastor said, I spent hours and hours and hours and hours listening to Bill Johnson's messages and reading his books, and sent us a long video of his critique. And I had someone on staff watch it and send me an outline. I said, yeah, those are fair questions. I'm glad he raised those questions. They're mine to answer. Okay. Those are great questions. I think he did a good, solid analysis. Good job. And he wasn't raising the silly stuff. He was raising real issues. Do I agree here? Do I disagree there? Well done. Great. So now ask Bill about that. Don't ask me. All right. So I'm just trying to help, friends. And trust me, I'm addressing this again because of the podcast last week. And then we're moving on because there are far more important issues to focus on. 866-34-TRUTH. Yeah. You know what it reminds me of? The fake news stuff you're dealing with constantly on TV. And then because the alt-right supported Donald Trump and the alt-right is often racist, then if you voted for Donald Trump, you're a racist. That, to me, would be a good parallel with the whole NAR conspiracy thing. All right, to the phones. We go to Sean in D.C. Welcome, sir, to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. Good to talk to you again.
Great.
Great. I had a question regarding how should we not necessarily interpret, but understand the book of Job, not to deviate from the NAR.
Oh, no. I wanted to tackle other questions today, so we're good.
Okay, perfect. So at the end, and of course, in Job 42 and 7, God says, he speaks to Eliphaz, and
yes.
He says, my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job has. My question, Dr. Brown, is when reading within those 42 chapters, when we see that it goes to Eliphaz and Job's other friends, how should we understand what they're saying in the narrative?
Let me jump in just for time's sake.
Sure.
You asked one of the best questions anyone could ask about the book of Job, because it gets to the heart of major issues. There are some commentaries who believe that when God commends Job, he's just talking about the verses that followed, the preceding verses where Job repented and said, you know, I'm nothing, and I spoke out of turn when he repented, and that's what God's speaking about. I don't accept that. I don't believe that's the case whatsoever. So your question is spot on, as they would say in Australia. How is it that Job, who is rebuked by God for speaking words he shouldn't have spoke, for darkening counsel with his words that were out of place, how is it that Job, who accuses God of being unjust, and basically God is behind all the disorder and chaos and pain in the world, and he treats the wicked and the righteous exactly the same, how is it that God could say of Job, he spoke rightly of me, but not like you and the friends? The friends said God punishes the wicked, God blesses the righteous. Why weren't they speaking rightly of God? Because they were wrongly applying certain biblical truths or certain spiritual truths to Job that didn't apply. They were wrongly implying that God had smitten Job because he was wicked, whereas in fact, Job was chosen because he was righteous. So they misrepresented God with their straitjacket theology. As for Job, and of course I get into this much more in my commentary, although he challenged God wrongly, he knew in his gut that if God was really the God he thought he was, that God had to bring justice. That if God was really the God who thought he was, that it was self-contradictory for him to be doing what he was doing. So on the one hand, he spoke wrongly of God by accusing him, but he spoke rightly in that his ultimate plea was to God, and his ultimate belief was that God would somehow vindicate him. So he fled from God to God, knowing that ultimately that there had to be justice in God's universe. And rather than just speaking empty theological maxims from his head, he spoke from his heart deep truths about justice being found in God's universe. I hope that answered succinctly. Thank you for the call.